human-powered flight.
The result was the Gossamer Condor.
The only obstacle left is the 10-foot finish pole.
A pilot pedaled MacCready's ultralight plane through the air. Paul MacCready won the prize. That first human-powered plane led to solar power planes. The planes led to cars, but the evolution was far from linear.
Ready?
Launching.
Enter the Raven, an AeroVironment drone. That's what you're hearing right now. You'll notice the company's fondness for ornithological nomenclature. Sergeant Michael Susted trained on the Raven in Afghanistan. It's so small, you can launch it with your bare hand.
It has cameras, GPS, so that when it comes back, we can brief our commanders what's going on at that location.
You might want to step back, sir, because I'm going to plug the charge cable in.
Roger Corey is a senior electronics engineer with AeroVironment in California.
The only sound that it will make will be a high-pitched whining. It sounds like somebody's whistling to a dog.
Corey's testing AeroVironment's other specialty, electric vehicle charging stations, made to line U.S. highways. The difference between his company's products doesn't escape him.
One flies and the other doesn't.
The core technologies are the same, though, and that means engineering staff can move from one side of the company to the other, and Department of Defense contracts pick up the tab for all kinds of new research and development, including the Switchblade, the first handheld drone that spies and shoots. When production began, Tim Conver, the company's current president, says he had to sit the staff down for a little talk.
And I think a lot of individuals that initially were a little taken back, what are we doing making weapon systems, either got comfortable with it or in some cases said, you know, I don't want to work on that program. I'm fine with us doing it, but I don't want to work on it myself. No problem.
When I asked Converse if the company had drifted from its beginnings, he said no.
I understand that it's conventional wisdom that you have defense and you've got environment here. But as you can see, I don't see any inherent conflict.
Drones make up over three-quarters of AeroVironment's revenue, and the industry is moving at a quick pace, with over 4% growth projected over the next 10 years. The future of AeroVironment's electric vehicle charger business is less predictable. That will depend on U.S. demand for electric cars. Amy Walters, NPR News.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL 580 AM. This year marks the 20th anniversary of a remarkable year for music. 1992 was arguably the year that rap music in America found its voice. Since then, hip-hop has completely changed the sound of American pop music. To honor the 20th anniversary of rap's most influential year, NPR is launching a special series today. NPR's Franny Kelly kicks it off with a record that spoke directly to the rioting in 1992, Dr. Dre's The Chronic.
On this day in 1993, there were still burned-out buildings in South Central Los Angeles. It hadn't been a year since the acquittal of four police officers in the videotaped beating of Rodney King. Anger at the verdict had not cooled, and you could hear it in the music on the radio.
Don't think I forgot, let you slide. Let me ride, just another homicide. Yeah, it's me, so I'ma talk on. Stomping on the easiest streets that you can walk on. So strap on your Compton hat, your locs, and watch your back, cause you might get smoked low.
Dr. Dre's The Chronic was in part a response to the riots, but its incendiary sound began long before the first match was lit. 5 years earlier, his first group, N.W.A., put out this song. Dre made the beat, and Ice Cube took the first verse.
The police coming straight from the underground. A young got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority.
NWA's tales of police brutality were not only prescient, they were also common knowledge, according to Matthew McDaniel, who was an intern at K-Day, a Los Angeles AM station devoted to hip-hop. He was also a filmmaker who interviewed just about everybody in the L.A. rap scene.
This is what was happening. This was the relationship with the cops and young black people, young Mexicans, and nobody seemed to care to even talk about it. So when they stepped out with that one, it was like, oh, my God.
The song was still huge when the Rodney King verdict came down on April 29th, 1992. The city erupted.
We're out here at First AME Church.
the day of the verdict of the Rodney King trial.
That's Matthew McDaniel in the documentary he later made about the 6 days of chaos that followed the verdict. His camera captured furious Angelenos, and one man in particular.
If you ain't down for the ones that suffered in South Africa of apartheid, damn it, you need to step your punk to the side and let us brothers and us Africans step in and start putting some foot in that ass.
McDaniel never got that man's name, but he says he listened to the clip over and over again.
I think he represented a million people that day.
And there was another man. While he's speaking, he lifts a toddler onto his shoulders.
I'm going to tell you right now, if I have to die today for this little African right here to have a future, I'm a dead mother right.
McDaniel says he knew he had powerful tape. A month after the riots, he heard Dr. Dre was working on a new album.
At that point in time, you could just call Dr. Dre up on the phone. You know, not so easy for people now, you know, but you could just get Dre's number, call him up, he'd pick up the phone, hello.
No, it's not so easy now. Dr. Dre wasn't interested in speaking to NPR, but in 1997, he did give an interview to the makers of a documentary called Rhythm and Rhyme.
The music talks about crime, violence, and drugs because it exists. I mean, for me, it's nothing political to it. Some people involve it in politics and what have you, but for me, I love doing it. And it also makes money. It's gonna better my life and my family's life.
Dre wanted to make an album that people would like enough to buy. He wound up using pieces of McDaniel's footage from the riots in not one, but two songs.
Wake up, jumped out my bed. I'm in a two-man cell with my homie little half dead. Murder was the case that they gave me. Dear God, I wonder, can you save me? I'm only 18, so I'm a young buck. It's a ride, if I don't scrap, I'm getting stuck. But that's the life of a G, I guess. Essays way deep, shank two in the chest. Best run, cause brothers is dropping quicker. Too late, damn, down goes another.
That one, Lil Ghetto Boy, and...
You need to step your punk to the side and let us brothers and us Africans step in and start putting some foot in that.
The hard-edged album made millions for Dre, his label, and the record stores that sold it. It was arguably the first rap album to reach well beyond the rap audience. But filmmaker Matthew McDaniel, whose clips Dr. Dre sampled, says back in 1993, not everybody was happy about rap's growing popularity.
People's parents, like, don't listen to that, you know, for one reason or another, racial reasons, cultural, the differences in generations. My family, I was the youngest out of six, and nobody appreciated it. They thought it was a complete waste of time.
But McDaniel says The Chronic is still worth listening to, even 20 years later.
It's a document. It's an audio document with a lot of creativity and art and entertainment going along with it. Some people might think that that's wrong, but it's art. It's poetry, and it's supposed to have pain in it. You can gather that from listening to The Chronic. About the L.A. riots, you can feel it. You can kind of understand. And a lot of people agree that they captured it incredibly well.
McDaniel says the album doesn't have all the answers, and it didn't solve the problems of its time. It's low-riding party music intended to provide an escape and a voice for the anger and frustration born of burned-out buildings, grinding poverty, and a feeling that nobody cared. Franny Kelly, NPR News.
Agricultural programming is made possible by the Illinois Pork Producers Association. Hey, join me, Todd Gleason, for a Market Outlook panel featuring Dan Zwicker, Sue Martin, and David Nelson, February 6th during the Illinois Pork Expo at the Peoria Civic Center. All farmers are welcome. More info at ilpork.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 22nd of January, 2013. It was on this day, 1938, Thornton Wilder's play Our Town premiered at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, about the fictional town of Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, Emily Webb and George Gibbs, children in the first act. In the second act, they marry. In the third, Emily has died in childbirth, and she's looking back from beyond the grave with other dead citizens of Grover's Corner. And she decides to revisit the happiest day of her life, her 12th birthday. Thornton Wilder had trouble writing that third act. It finally came to him when he was in Zurich. He was entertaining a friend who was probably also his lover, Samuel Steward. The two of them stayed up until dawn to hear the bells of Zurich. There was some drinking going on. It was raining. They were looking for an umbrella. And Thornton Wilder wrote the last act of Our Town, beginning with the graveyard scene, with the umbrellas. And he told Samuel Steward that the graveyard scene came from Steward's complaining about his feet getting wet as he was walking home. The play was revolutionary for its time. Wilder had decided not to use scenery, almost no props. He wanted his play to be more like the great Greek tragedies, and the dead people sitting in the cemetery commented, much like a Greek chorus. From Princeton, the play went on to Boston, where it was a flop. It got bad reviews, played to half-empty houses. Some audience members walked out. But two influential New York theater critics, Brooks Atkinson and Alexander Wolcott, convinced the director and producer to give it another try and bring it to New York. And it did better there. And it won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, 1938. And it's now estimated that, on average, Our Town is performed at least once every night somewhere in the world. It's the birthday of the novelist Aaron Kyle, born in Peoria, 1978, grew up in Colorado, the town of Grand Junction. She liked horses, she took riding lessons, competed in horse shows, went off to college, and while she was in grad school, she wrote a short story called Foaling Season about a girl who lives on a horse ranch in a town called Desert Valley. It was published in the Atlantic Monthly, won the National Magazine Award for Fiction, and she turned it into a novel called The God of Animals. The Foaling Season is the first chapter of the book, and The God of Animals became a bestseller. The God of Animals, which begins 6 months before Polly Kane drowned in the canal, my sister Nona ran off and married a cowboy. Here's a poem for today by Deborah Garrison, entitled Poem.